Welcome to Growth Marketing Today, where marketers, designers, and product owners level up their growth marketing chops from experts in today's top startups. Here's your host, Ramley John.
This is episode 44 of Growth Marketing Today. I'm your host, Ramley John, and I'm here on a mission to help marketers like you sharpen their skills by talking to some of today's top marketing experts. Today is all about customer research-backed growth plan to grow 2 to 3 times faster. According to research done by ProfitWell, SaaS companies that invested in customer research grew 2 to 3 times faster than companies that didn't. So if you want to go faster, you got to be doing customer research. The problem is that 65% of marketers rarely do customer research. I hope that's not one of you. That's where Caitlin Burgoyne, my guest for today, comes in. Her mission is to make customer research sexy again. She helps frustrated product and marketing teams use customer insights to guide innovation and identify untapped growth opportunities. In this episode, Caitlin reveals her step-by-step process in helping companies identify their best customers and the triggers that make them buy more. So now if you want the show notes, my takeaways, any tweetable quotes, and more from this episode, you can go to growthmarketing.today/044. And if you're new here, please subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Breaker, wherever it is. As always, I'd really appreciate it if you leave a feedback wherever you get this podcast. If it's on Apple Podcasts, I would appreciate a 5-star review so we can reach more marketers with this podcast. I don't want to hold you any further. Let's listen in on my chat with Caitlin. Hey, everybody here. I have Caitlin, who is an expert in customer research. I'm super excited to dig into this because everybody that I've talked to so far in this podcast the last few weeks, the last few months, have been talking about marketers need to talk to their customers, and you are going to talk to us about how you do that. Caitlin, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. This is a topic I'm super nerdy about, so I'm pumped to share it with your listeners.
I love it when people get nerdy about what they're passionate about. And before we talk about what you're working on right now, Customer Cam, and other things about customer research, maybe you can tell my listeners a little bit about your career journey. I noticed you are a 3X founder, and now you're lead trainer at Customer Camp. How did you do that transition?
That's a great story. So it certainly wasn't a straight line. The kind of like short version of it is I started a little freelance business when I graduated from college, ended up growing that into a branding agency. And I think at our largest, we were a team of 8. And I was enjoying the work. I was getting to work with some cool clients. Like I got to work with clients like Target and Holiday Inn, but I was starting to get a little bored. I wanted to do something bigger. I wanted to do something more scalable. And at the time I kind of narrowed it down to 2 options. It was like, either I'm going to do a startup and I had an idea for my startup, or I'm going to do like an online course or create some online training material. And at the time I thought that the online course world was starting to get a little bit saturated, and this was 2014.
Wow.
So it's a lot more saturated now than it used to be. I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do an app. An app's like a bigger opportunity, right? Like play big. I was a little naive in reflection. Like I really didn't realize what I was getting into, which is probably good because I probably wouldn't have done it. And I don't regret having done it because I learned amazing lessons. But then I launched our startup. It was called Vendive. It was a business network for women entrepreneurs. We raised venture capital. We were growing quickly. We were getting lots of press. Forbes was calling us the next LinkedIn for women, but the product was not strong. I was good on the marketing side. I was great at, you know, getting people to sign up, getting the word out. The product itself was glitchy and buggy and didn't solve the right problems. And so after 2 pivots, basically it came down to realizing, okay, like what I've got right now, I can like either turn into a lifestyle business, which is not what I'd promised my investors, and it wasn't the vision I'd set out to achieve. Or I can wrap this up and try something new. And I decided to go with the latter. So that was 2017. For the last 2 years, I kind of decided, what do I want to be when I grow up? And that brought me to where I am now. Oh, and I had another business as well, a restaurant consulting business that I sold after about a year. So That's the third one.
Wow. Now, it's funny you say that you've started all this company, because some of the best growth marketers I know are very entrepreneurial. They've started the companies in the past, or they have a bunch of side hustles right now. How has being a founder of three companies helped you become a better growth strategist?
I guess I would say when you don't have any resources, you have to figure shit out pretty quickly. So
that's true.
You know, being a founder of an early stage company, whether you're doing an agency, whether you're doing an info product, or whether you're doing a tech company, oftentimes, if you're like most people, you start off with no resources and you need to figure out how to make something from nothing. And so when you're in that position, you need to get wily. And so that's kind of always been the driver for me, was just trying to figure out how to make it work with what I have. And my background, while it initially was in PR, I started working in advertising in an advertising agency, and really quickly realized that what I was most passionate about was marketing. And kind of more specifically, I was really passionate about guerrilla marketing, which was something that was kind of new and coming onto the scene in 2010 when I started my first company. And so I've always just been, I guess, I'm a bit of a futurist. Gallup has their strengths finders assessment, and they're like, you can do this assessment, and they'll tell you like what your top five strengths are. And one of my top five is futurist, because I would always see, where the market was going pretty quickly. And sometimes too quickly that I would actually be way ahead of it, like skipping out on doing online courses in 2013 when it would have been probably a great time to get into the market. I was like, that's going to be done soon. But it took 5 minutes to really reach, or 5 years rather, to reach full saturation. Now it's still saturated, but you can still start today. I would say what it came down to was just seeing where things were going and getting a sense of what was going to work in the future. And so when you think about growth, it moves so, so fast. And there's so much competition today that you've just really got to be on top of it and paying attention to kind of like what's coming next, because the things that used to work just won't.
So now you said you call yourself a futurist. That's actually a cool title, so to speak. Before I talk about that, like, what is Customer Camp for my listeners who might not know what it is?
Sure. So when I decided to close down my own tech company, Vendive, I was like, what am I going to do with my life? Like, you know, I'm licking my wounds. I'm like sad and broke. And I'm like, now what? And luckily for me, I had built an amazing network in the startup community here in Atlantic Canada. And so I had a lot of friends who had startups and needed help with marketing. And while I wasn't good on the product side initially, I was good on the marketing side. So a lot of my friends, I got to work with them. And, you know, I came down and I would sit in their boardrooms and I would hear oftentimes the same story, which is I'd say, you know, tell me about your customers. Because as a marketer, you have to understand the customers. You need to know what they want, what they need, and how to create value for them. And so often those teams would they'd talk around the question and they'd have a couple different customers they were going after and they weren't quite sure. And some of these teams had raised, you know, millions of dollars because they were awesome when it came to building cool tech, but really were struggling when it was coming to figure out who actually wanted it and how to get people to buy it. And so I just realized that there was this gap, and that while a lot of companies were great at building product, they weren't great at selling product and promoting product and explaining people why they should use their products. And that all just comes back to really understanding your customers. So that was what led to me starting Customer Camp. And Customer Camp is essentially, we have a couple of workshops that we do both in person, and I'm soon going to be bringing them online. And I teach people how to identify who their best customers are and figure out what triggers those customers to buy so that they can write more compelling copy and, you know, be in the right place at the right time and just avoid kind of spinning their wheels, which is what a lot of them are doing right now. So that's Customer Camp.
Interesting that you say that. Yeah, I read a stat there that says 65% of marketers rarely do audience research. Mm-hmm. And I find this absolutely nuts. Like, almost every person I've talked to in this podcast so far is like, you're going to need to talk to customer. I'm curious, just based on talking to a bunch of founders and other marketers, what's the number one reason or number one or two reason why marketers aren't doing customer research? Is it lack of time or maybe pressure from the leadership team?
It's a combination of things. And you mentioned that some of the folks you've talked to, they all say this is so important. And they absolutely, like, one of the neat things about working in startups and technology specifically is, like, oftentimes the people on those teams are way ahead of where the market's going, because they have to be. And it's way more competitive than it used to be. But, like, when you look at marketers that are, you know, working in agencies and working inside of companies that aren't tech startups, like, this is still something that they, for a lot of them, it isn't even on their radar. Like, I did a ton of my own customer research. So I was thinking about creating a new product specifically to train agencies on how to do qualitative customer research, meaning going out and talking to customers to understand them. And I talked to a bunch of people who I know who own agencies and people who work in agencies, and all of them said, we'd love to do more research, but we can't because our clients will not pay for it. And so I think it's a number of things. I think part of it is oftentimes companies, when they bring a marketer on their team or when they hire marketers externally, such as an agency, they think that they already know what the customer wants, and they certainly don't want to waste time, because it does take time to do this research, on doing research if they think they already know what they want. So they're like, don't worry about doing research. I'll tell you what you need to know about our customers. And that's not always very effective, because it's really hard to empathize with a customer. And to be a great marketer, you need to be very empathetic. You have to be good at empathizing with your customer's needs when you've never actually talked to them. You've never actually, you've never experienced the problem that your customers have. So that's part of it. I think that part of it is that teams want to move quickly. They want to be the go-to source for information about what the customer cares about, and they don't want to waste time or money doing audience research because they don't think it's necessary. So I think that's part of it.
Let's say you have a manager. They're like, we already know who our customers are, who our best customers are. Why do you want to do research? Like, what would be your advice for marketers, whether that's in a startup or an agency, to get buy-in from their manager, company leadership?
That's a great question. And so I know that our mutual friend, Gia, from one of the hosts of Forget the Funnel, somebody on the Forget the Funnel podcast, I believe her name's Allie Bloom, just did a great webinar specifically on that topic. So if you're looking to get buy-in to do customer research, check out that Forget the Funnel episode. What I would say is, what I did when I started talking to founders and marketers about doing audience research, and what I would see was a lot of glazed over eyes. So I was like, wow, okay, the way that I'm positioning this isn't working, because nobody wants or cares about audience research. What they want is to grow faster. What they want is to stop wasting time and creating content that nobody pays attention to. What they want is to be able to clearly articulate who their customers are, versus feeling like they're kind of just chasing whoever will hang out with them and listen to them at all. So the way that I kind of reframed what I do is, like, well, the how of what I do is through audience research. The what is always about clarity and growth. Like, people want to know who their customers are, and they want to know what triggers those customers to buy so that they can sell more stuff. The fact that I need to do research or teach them how to do research to achieve those things, they're like, okay, cool. But when you talk about research as a standalone thing, right, without talking about that value, you don't get a lot of buy-in.
It's funny, you're repositioning the audience research itself to reposition maybe the company's product or service. Mm-hmm. And so let's jump into your process. Like, what are your steps for doing customer research? Let's say either a startup or an agency, once again, they hire you to do this for them instead of getting training from you. What would be your process?
So my process is pretty simple. Essentially, I sit down with the team and it's like, what is the actual objective? Like, why are we working together on this in the first place? What is it that's not working? What are you trying to achieve? And we come up with the objective together. So once I know what the objective is, it's like, okay, so what don't we know? What questions don't we have answers to that would help us to achieve that objective. And we'll figure out kind of like what those questions are. And I like to call those the research questions. Those are the things that you're trying to answer. It's not necessarily the questions you're going to ask your customers specifically, but it's the things that you don't know that is that are holding you back and stopping you from achieving your objectives. So it might be things like, you know, if the objective is to, to increase customer acquisition, then one of the research questions might be, you know, who are our best customers? Who loves what it is we do? So if we, once I determine kind of like, what are the questions, you know, what's the objective? What are we trying to answer? I'll sit down with the team and we'll come up with our assumptions around those questions. So if, you know, if the question is who's our ideal customer, we'll come up with a list of assumptions. This is great because what it allows me to do is get everybody kind of engaged in the research and also kind of like pulls all of the, you know, everybody's kind of maybe unspoken thoughts out into the world. And during that first meeting, quite often what will become painfully evident is that you've got some really smart people all working together with very different assumptions about some really critical things. And so it's great because it helps the team to, you know, get engaged in the research, to be excited about the outcome. And it's eye-opening because they go, oh, like we were not on the same page and we, you know, we're kind of all moving quickly and some of us are moving in different directions and that's a problem. So that's usually step one is like, you know, getting the team together, figuring out what they want to achieve, what are the things that they don't know? What are we actually looking for answers for to, and what are the assumed answers and how close are we in terms of that being shared knowledge across the team. So then I'll go out and my preferred process is to talk to their current customers and talk to customers who recently bought, because understanding why somebody recently bought your product, understanding the buying journey that they went through that led to them deciding to choose that product has an enormous amount of really valuable information in it. And unlike asking somebody for an opinion, like asking somebody, do you see yourself using this product? Or, you know, what do you think motivated you to use this product? You just get them to tell you their story and you get them to tell it in exacting detail, because people lie when you ask them for their opinions, but it's harder to lie when you're asking them just to like tell you their story. So usually I'll do, we'll kind of identify one, maybe two customer segments that we want to talk to, because maybe we want to differentiate between this audience and that audience and see how they're different. And then I'll go out and I'll do the research and I'll usually interview between 5 and 10 people. And then I take all of that research, which I've recorded everything, and I get that transcribed. And then I go and I actually go through every word in kind of detail. And I analyze it and I kind of pull out key bits of information that are relevant. I've got this process of doing this. And from that, I start to spot really valuable patterns. I start to spot patterns around things like what triggers people to first start thinking about looking for a new solution. What are the catalysts along their buying journey, the things that push them towards actually buying something, the things that actually motivated them to step forward towards making change. What are the things that were barriers that could have stopped them from buying? You know, did they have anxieties about buying the new thing? Were there constraints or things in their way? Maybe they had to convince somebody else that it was the right decision and that slowed down the process. So these are all the things I'm kind of listening for along that buying journey. And then, you know, usually one of these calls will last about maybe 30 minutes. The first 20 are typically dedicated just to tell me all these different steps. What other products did you try? What other things did you consider? How did you find out about those things? What made you interested in trying them? All of that. And then usually about the last 10 minutes is more about, okay, so now you're using the product. Tell me about your experience. Like, is it helping you? What do you like? What don't you like? And then I get more information around their satisfaction with the product. A lot of this is kind of based on work done by people in the jobs to be done community. So I've leveraged a lot of the way that they think about how to pull great insight out of customers through interviews. But I've really kind of over time shaped and created my own process that works well for me. And that's what I teach people how to do. Because I love jobs to be done style thinking. It was a game changer for me in how I think about things. It's can be tricky to communicate to people because they don't quite get it, or they go off and start doing some research around it and get a bit confused because there's a lot of kind of controversial and very different approaches to doing jobs to be done style research. And it's kind of often touted as this one size fits all tool that you can use and it's kind of magic. But in a lot of companies' cases, depending on where they're at, how many customers they have, what their style of business is, it's not the right solution for them. So it's something that a lot of my stuff, it's derived from job style thinking, but I definitely deviate from it as needed for research projects.
Now, do you use any surveys at all, or is mainly driven by interviews?
I do use surveys. So basically the purpose of the interviews is to kind of pull out some key insights to look and see like, okay, what do we believe to be true here? You know, of the assumptions that we made going into this, how many of those feel like they were validated? And the qualitative research allows us to then create a quantitative study to follow up. So if we talk to 10 people for interviews, then we'd come up with some, okay, we've heard the X, Y, and Z. Now we want to quantify this. Let's go and survey 500 people. So let's see if what we heard in those interviews aligns with what we get back in the surveys. And if the surveys come back and it's like what you were expecting to see looks totally different than what you heard in the interviews, then you can kind of pause and go, okay, like, is there a possibility that our interviews were off? It was a small sample size. It wasn't like, you know, we misinterpreted what they meant. Like, that's never happened yet, really. Like, there's never been a case where it was like, something came out clearly in the interviews and then was disproved with the quantitative research. But a lot of teams, especially technical teams, they want to see that there is a decent sample size for the research. So if I say five people said this, they go, ah, those are just five people. But if I say five people said this, so then we asked this question to 500 people and got back a very similar answer. And they're like, okay. So sometimes it's more about just getting people to buy in than it is about actually needing to do that next step, but that next step helps them to buy in.
That's something that I heard from Google Research or something like that, where like if you talk to 5 to 10 customers, you probably already know the problems that they have like 80 to 90% of the time. I'm curious if you offer any incentives to the customers to get them on the call, because I think that could maybe one of the barriers that you see with getting customers to jump on a call.
It can be a challenge. And so I have offered incentives. One of the things that my go-to is usually between a $20 Amazon gift card, which Amazon makes really, really easy to do. Like, you can basically go to their website and you can say, I want 10 gift cards and email them to these 10 emails. And then like, it's like 3 clicks and you've given out your incentive. Or what I'll do is I'll say, you know, I'd really love some of your time. And, you know, in gratitude, I'd be happily make a donation to your favorite charity. And that typically gets people too, because you're like, okay, it's just a little bit of my time.
Right.
And you're going to pay it forward. I'll give you a few minutes. But the other thing is, depending on the client, a lot of their customers are just super happy to talk. Because like, if they're people who are passionate with the product, like understand the problem, they want to help figure out how to make the product better. They want to solve the problem. And so I don't always offer the incentive right away. I'll kind of send out a few test emails without it and see what the response rate is. And then if I'm not getting, if it's crickets, then I'll try doing an incentive.
And how do you position it? Do you say, hey, we're trying to create a better product, add more features that you'd be interested of, or we just want to hear from you? How do you position the initial email to get them on a call?
It depends. So like if it's something, if I can identify, so if I can say like, I want to talk to these 5 people, your customers that would look sort of like this, or maybe they recently bought, maybe they recently had this interaction with the product. I'll try to reach out to them and kind of, I want to shape it so that it's kind of more based around like, we know you wrote in to support looking for like help with this, like that's, you know, we're actually working on something similar to that. And, you know, we'd love to get your feedback on it. Like, can I get some of your time? So I try to make it contextual to them when possible. I try to make them feel like they're an expert. So as opposed to it being like, yeah, you're just another user and maybe you'll have an interview with me. It's like, okay, like I picked you specifically because I know that you blah, blah, blah. Right. So if I can see that they're, you know, if I can go look at their Twitter profile, look at their LinkedIn profile, and I can actually reach out to them in a way that, that is personalized, that tends to work a lot better. Many of my clients that I've done this work with as a consultant either have a fairly responsive audience where it doesn't take a lot of prodding, or they have a fairly large audience of people that, like, you know, they're getting, you know, hundreds of new customers a day. And so you can reach out to somebody when they just bought and they're kind of like, it's like, I know that you just bought. We're looking to learn from people who made the decision. And because you just bought, like, you're going to have so many great insights. Would you share that with me? And so then because they just bought, usually they remember their buying story really, really right. well. And they're kind of more open right. to hopping on a call.
Now, how do you take all this research into something that's actionable? And something that I've heard repeatedly is like you help companies figure out who the best customers are. So mm-hmm. taking all this research, how can you a company figure out their best customers?
Well, the thing is that with the kind of like with the background on Jobs to be Done, the focus of Jobs to be Done is, you know, understanding why people are using your product in the first place. What is it they're trying to achieve? What progress are they trying to make? How do they feel stuck? And what I'll often find when I do this type of research is that if I talk to, let's say we talk to like two different segments, five people from each segment, oftentimes what I'll find is that there's a clear difference between the expected value between those two segments. So, you know, the reason why they bought, what they were hoping to get, their satisfaction with what they have, it often really, there's often some clear differences. And from the company's perspective, it's like, we can't serve everyone. And if we try to, cater to these two very different audiences that bought with two kind of quite different outlooks in mind, we're going to end up creating a bloated product. So really what I help people do in the earlier stages of innovation, when they've got a little bit of traction, but they don't have what they would expect, then it's like, maybe you're not targeting the right people. So let's actually, like, maybe you think that you should be targeting these people. Let's go talk to some of these people who are using a similar product to yours, and see what their experience is like with it. Because oftentimes it's people think that they, you know, if they don't have product market fit, they think, okay, it's got to be something wrong with the product. And they just keep adding features and features and features, thinking like eventually these are going to work, without really giving a ton of thought to the actual market side of it. And sometimes it's really about shifting the market you're going after less than making all these big changes to your product.
Right. No, that's so true. Now, one other question that I have is, like, you have all this research. How do you get the whole team to consume it? Like, do you write it down in document format, or do you...
So I'm always experimenting that with, like, I'll give reports. I'll go and do a presentation with the team. The thing that, one of the things that I'm working on, and one of the things that friends have, like, I have a friend who's kind of like working on a startup around this actually. The tricky part with this type of work is that, people don't read reports.
That's true.
And it's really like they basically want the answers to the questions that matter most to them. So I'm always kind of working on, how do I refine the way that I deliver or get my students who are learning this process, how do they deliver a product back to their teams that their teams are actually going to be able to action really easily? So it's something that I'm always working on. Right now, it's a combination of there's the report. I'll do a presentation where I'll kind of like, these are the key findings. And then once I kind of present a key finding, I'll kind of shape it what I call a how might we question. for instance, with one of my clients that I'm doing a project for right now, one, let me see if I, how much of this example I can give without giving away what it is they do. Basically, I discovered, like, I broke down, this was a project where we were using job suit and style research. And so I identified through the interviews kind of four primary jobs that mattered to these two different audiences. And then once you kind of, I kind of identified one of those jobs, the next piece is I kind of like give some examples of when I, you know, voice of the customer, as they say, this is what I heard people say around this. But then I craft it into what's called a how might we question. So a how might we question is basically, it's the start of a brainstorm. So once I tell them what the specific job is that I've unearthed, like, you know, this is what these customers want, this is why they bought, this is what they're trying to achieve, then it's like, well, how might we leverage that information to do X? And the X is something that I know is important to that team already. It allows me to kind of, without being prescriptive about what they should do with this information next, to guide them towards coming, using this information to the, like, get to the next logical step, and to make them feel like they have ownership over it. Because if I just present them with a whole bunch of data, and then I say later, like, yeah, here's all the things your customer said, and here's what I think they mean, and then I just take off, they don't care. They're not invested. They don't feel ownership over the process. And so they're less likely to action it. It's more likely to go sit on a back burner somewhere without people actually actioning it, or people trying to, you know, people kind of cherry picking the pieces that they want that help, like, that help them with what they want to do right now, versus actually looking at the whole context. So I do find that those how might we questions work really well. It's like, here's the thing we learned. How might we leverage this in this way, and then start a dialogue about that? So then they get pumped up about that finding and what it means, and how we can kind of use that insight within the product, within their marketing, within their sales.
Yeah. So, like, an example would be, how might we use this for our homepage copy, or?
Exactly. Exactly. So immediately getting them thinking about, you know, like, how they can take that insight and what that means to the individual teams, because so often people get stuck in kind of siloed departmental thinking. And it's like, if they can't see how that insight is relevant to product, or relevant to sales, or relevant to, like, their content creators, they just ignore it. So it's like, okay, no, I need them to see how they're going to use this.
Right. And you're taking it from, like, something theoretical to something that's very applicable, mm-hmm, to whatever they're doing at that point.
And it's super fun, because, like, they get to feel like they've won, and they're kind of like the winners of the solution. But these insights were things that they didn't necessarily know how to get on their own, or want to invest the time to get on their own. So the not knowing how is really a huge barrier for a lot of people, because they go out and they, you know, they want to do audience research. They're bought in to the fact that they should be doing it, but they don't know how to do it. And so that's, like, you know, when I work with consulting clients, I always do it in a done with you model, where somebody from their team has to get designated as the customer advocate or the audience advocate. And that person is going to be on the calls with me. They're going to be going through, when we get everything transcribed, they're going to be going through and categorizing things with me. I want somebody on that internal team to learn the process, so that when I go off and I'm gone, they can keep doing it. And it becomes something that now they have that skill on their team, versus, okay, Caitlin did that for us once and now we're never going to do it again, or we'll bring her back in 18 months to do it again, because we don't know how to do it on our own.
Has there been a time where, like, you left and then they just completely left it off? Like, what are some big mistakes that some teams do when it comes to customer research?
I think that the thing that I would see most often, mistake-wise, is, again, they cherry-pick the pieces that fit the narrative that they already wanted to do anyway. That's a problem that you see often more in larger organizations than small ones. Like, I work with a lot of very early-stage startups on the training side. Sometimes it's, you know, one- or two-person teams, super early-stage on the training side. And then on the consulting side, I work with larger companies. But on the larger company front, it's like they cherry-pick the things that they want already. And you sometimes see that with smaller companies too. Like, when they learn the process, they'll go out and do their research, but anything that kind of doesn't align with what their previously decided approach was going to be. They kind of just like, eh. But then they always end up regretting it.
That's so funny.
They learn their lessons. So many of them come back to me and said, like we knew this, you know, 6 months ago, but you get some cost fallacy, right? You've already spent a lot of time and energy on something and you just want to see it through, even if there's some evidence that it's not the best way to go.
So how do you remove that bias then? Like, is there any exercise or suggestion you would have for removing that? Hey, I think we already know what we need to do and we're just going to back that up with the research, and you really, they're completely wrong.
I think that's a tough thing to do. So I think it's around this, like the process of them. The reason I come in and I want to kind of like have that customer advocate is because like that person's job when I'm gone is to do that same thing again, which is like, what are the assumptions? What are the things we don't know? And it's about kind of like building that humility in the team that there's going to be a lot of stuff that you're going to be wrong about and that that's okay. And it's better to be wrong about something. And like, it can be frustrating for teams when they kind of have put a lot of effort into something and then there's not a lot of evidence that it was the right decision, which is why this stuff's so hard. Like, you know, like if you look at ProfitWell did this massive study of 3,000 software companies, and they were ranging between the size of like under $100,000 a year up to, I think, $10 million a year in recurring revenue. So like very different sizes. And of those companies, 70% of them were doing fewer than 10 customer conversations a month, not trying to sell stuff. So like if they're trying to learn, 70% of them were doing fewer than 10. And the ones that were doing 10 or more were growing 2 to 3 times faster than the other ones. And when you hear something like that, it's just like, oh, well, it's so easy. It's so obvious. Why are people so stupid? But they're not stupid, because I always like to describe, it's like diet and exercise. Like everybody on the planet that's ever tried to lose weight has tried all these fad diets. You've tried all these different things. It's actually really hard to do. And while diet and exercise works, it takes an enormous amount of discipline and oftentimes changing approaches to things that are hard. Making big changes is hard. And so I always kind of like to be empathetic to the fact that if it were easy, everybody would do it. It's not easy, but it does work. And so it's something where you have to kind of like get motivated, get excited, get your team aligned around it, and accept that it's going to be a different approach and a different way of doing things. Because the thing is, when you think about audience research from a jobs to be done perspective, if somebody's not going to do audience research, what other ways might they be able to figure out what to do? Like there's so many other ways that require way less energy and time than audience research. You can sit in a boardroom and brainstorm stuff. You can like come up with the ideas on your own, right? You can go out and read some market stats and studies and try to like glean insight from there. So there's lots of other ways to try to figure out what to do and to try to get clarity that aren't as challenging as doing audience research. The thing is, they just aren't as effective either. So it's like you can do those things, but so often they aren't as effective.
And they're still based on assumptions, right? Like mm-hmm. with here, you're actually gathering some both qualitative and quantitative data to back up those assumptions versus getting research insights from paying $10,000 for some kind of report to get some insights about your customers. We don't know if those customers, those folks are actually going to be your customers.
Well, that's it. Like a lot of larger companies too, like they'll pay to get these third-party studies on particular audiences. And it's like, you read these things and it's like, this is basically the purpose of that report is to make you feel like you made data-driven decisions. It's not necessarily because you are making a data-driven decision. Like it makes you sleep better at night because it's like, well, we got the data, but like, it's not data from your customers and it's not about your product.
Right. Yeah. And they're data driven, but it's bad data driven versus good data driven.
And I mean, that's still better than not doing anything. Somebody went out and did that research, but they didn't do it with your specific product in mind or talking to your specific customers. So it's going to be broad and potentially misleading. But more often than not, probably better than just going on gut. But yeah, in a lot of cases, it's broad and can be misleading.
So then have you worked with a larger company instead of like agencies or startups? And you know, what kind of challenges did you find working with that bigger company?
I've worked with a couple larger clients. You know, my largest client has about 500 employees. One of the things that's more difficult, they're kind of more of a traditional established business. They're not a startup per se, but they're going to be, they're in an industry that's like, you know, requires them to make some rapid changes. That's an industry that really has gotten disrupted and needs to figure out its way from here. And the, I think part of the challenge of working with those companies is that they know that they need to make changes and that they, you know, they're excited to make those changes, but you also have to make it somebody's job in on your internal team to be the champion for this new way of working. And it's hard because like a lot of, again, like it requires a lot of change. And a lot of people, when I'm brought in, like if somebody gets assigned to be that customer advocate who's going to be working with me, but they still have their regular day-to-day responsibilities. And so, yes, the team's like, yeah, you're going to work with Caitlin, you're going to help her out. But on top of that, they still need to do all the other stuff that they're supposed to do. And so I think one of the changes that you're going to see coming in the years to come, and it's already happening, is you're going to see a lot more UX researchers, a lot more product managers, and a lot more people hiring those people earlier, because those people, like their job is essentially to talk to customers. Like that's their job. But in a lot of teams, you don't have somebody whose job that is. And so it gets pushed to the side. So I'd say that's one of the problems. It's like these, like, you know, these companies are busy, they're moving quickly. They've got, you know, they can't just stop because you don't do a research project. They still need to work towards other things. And the people internally that are your champions and that are working alongside you, they have their own responsibilities that are separate from this project that they still need to be accountable for. And so I'd say that it's kind of like that fight for resources. It's like, you know, if we want to move fast, you've got to be able to dedicate time to this. But if you can't dedicate time for this, it's going to end up taking a lot longer. And then we'll kind of like lose some of the momentum and the excitement from the team because it's been a while since we first started talking with this and now time's kind of dredged on. So I'd say that's a problem I've seen.
One of the things you just said is that, you know, going forward, what you see in the future is companies will be hiring for user research or UX teams. Is there anything else you can see coming in the future for whether startups or bigger companies in terms of either user research, marketing, or anything else?
I think that there's all sorts of things going to be converging at once, which is that we, you know, consumers we just have so much choice, and we're not loyal anymore like we used to be. We will very quickly kind of turn on a brand or a product if something else comes along that we think is going to be better. And it used to be really hard to build stuff. And because it was really hard to build stuff, there wasn't as much competition and customers weren't as choosy or you know, disloyal. And so I think that with that change, that's what's ushering in this next era, which is, you know, marketers have been talking about customer experience being the ultimate kind of unequalizer for a while, but not really living it. They talk about wanting to be customer centric, but they're not actually going out and talking to customers. They're not actually putting that time in. They say that they care about customers, but when you ask customers, what was the stat? I think it was 75% of companies surveyed in this big survey said that they, you know, creating a great customer experience was a incredibly important priority to them. And then they like talked to hundreds of thousands of consumers across these companies. And of those consumers, 30% of them reported that they felt like they were getting a good customer experience. So there's obviously this big like gap between what companies want to do, what they're trying to do, and what their customers are experiencing. So I think that you'll see a lot more to kind of close that gap, a lot more efforts to close that gap.
And you made a good point that customers are becoming less loyal. Are you seeing that both for the consumer side and also in the B2B space?
Absolutely. I mean, with a lot of B2B software, you kind of get stuck in it. Like, you know, depending on how your team's growing and what you use it for, there's a lot of stuff that kind of the stickiness just comes from we've used it for a while and it's too much friction to switch. But there is a lot more competition and a lot more competition in business model, competition in feature set. And so I think in the B2B space, there's so many B2B SaaS tools now, like the MarTech thing. Like, if your listeners are familiar with the growth of that, like, I think it was 2011, there were 150 different marketing technology companies. And by 2018, there were 8,000. So like the growth is just every year, it's just like massively grown. But, you know, you're a marketer, like, could we ever even think about or make space in our brain to know that 8,000 different tools exist? Like, of course not.
I want to shift gears a bit and ask for your advice for anybody who wants to get started with customer research. Do you have any tools available on your website or anywhere else online?
Sure. So right now, by the time your listeners are listening to this, I might have launched my new website. It's been kind of in the works for a little while, but it got backburnered with a few other projects. But I would say you can check out my website, and there is a sign up there for a tool called my customer ranking calculator. And that's a great little tool to help you think about different customer segments and kind of like think about them and compare them to each other and identify which one might be the best high-value customer segment for you. I have a webinar that I did with Forget the Funnel where I talk about my process for audience research, and I really kind of give a crash course on how that process works, and link out to a sign up for a guide on that kind of like includes some tips on how to do it, and then also a tool to allow you to kind of gather and analyze your research. So those resources are out there. Aside from that, you know, follow me on Twitter. And if you have questions, I'm always happy to point people in the right direction and tell them about the best stuff to check out. And I'm working on a few more online training materials so that people can get the skill under their belt. So there's a few things coming down the pipe.
Awesome. No, that's great. For my listeners who don't know, what is your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is KateBour. So my name's Caitlin Burgoyne, and it's Kate Bohr is the Twitter handle.
I got to ask this. You get such a great engagement on Twitter. How do you come up with your tweets? Like, you're getting a bunch of like likes and retweets on your tweets.
So I would say like I eat my own dog food, but I do a lot of audience research, and I, you know, I'm paying attention to what people who represent my ideal audience, what are they interested in, what kind of topics are most compelling to them. And so I do my own audience research, and then the unsexy answer is that I, you know, algorithms work in a certain way, and because I've, you know, if you keep producing hits, they keep giving you eyeballs. And so I think with Twitter's, I just kind of got into this great flow about 6 months ago. And it just gives me a lot of visibility, which gives me a lot of lift. And so that's something that you have to kind of, you can engineer it by listening to your customers, but getting that momentum takes time and it takes some luck. You know, I had a couple posts go viral, and that helps. But the way that I kind of maintain that momentum is by continuing to kind of do my own audience research, following what they're interested in, seeing what they're talking about, and then trying to craft tweets that are going to be engaging for them.
That's so cool. You're doing your own process for your own tweets. That's really interesting. Do you take some time to like an hour in a month to actually think up of these tweets, or you just like to write it up on the spot?
So I have in the Forget the Funnel webinar, I kind of talk about my audience research process. But what I recommend people do is like, if you set aside 5 to 10 minutes a day to go off and do what I call creeping. So you can go to these different places, you know, you figure out where your customers are hanging out, and you go and you get your creep on, then you can start seeing things that are interesting and starting to kind of collect and save those for later. And then what I do is I set aside about 30 minutes a week to kind of filter through some of that and decide what I'm going to take from it. And I, you know, but I also, if I come up with something and I think it's going to be good, I'll just put it out there too. So it's kind of a little bit of like, you know, this is like my consciousness in the moment, just kind of like writing stuff. And then if I come up with something that I think is going to be good, I'll sometimes just email myself a reminder of what I thought was good. But mostly, you know, mostly it comes from just being conscious when I'm scrolling myself, when I'm in places where my audience is hanging out, about what they seem to be interested in, what they're talking about, and then answering that. And for me, what's interesting about audience research is that I think it really, a lot of marketers especially, but also product people, are feeling a lot of frustration about how hard it is. And so my kind of like, my perspective or my kind of my voice around the fact that, yeah, it's hard and it's hard, like this is why it's hard and this is what to do about it, I think for a lot of them is very validating because it's probably what they want to do anyway, but maybe haven't been given the time or space to do. So I think that for a lot of them, they like to engage with it because like, yes, this is the answer. Now I just need to be able to figure out how to get the time to do it.
That's so good. That's a great place to wrap up. I just want to thank you for your time. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your Friday to jump on a podcast.
Well, thank you. This has been a blast.
Wow, that episode was so good. It's so action-packed. There's so much information there about customer research that I didn't think about. Let me share my three key takeaways from this episode as always. First, it's okay to admit that you don't know. Now, one of the first steps of Caitlin's customer research process is to gather the team and ask the question, what don't we know? What don't we know about our customers? What don't we know about our products? It's tempting to fill in the blanks with assumptions. Now, audience research really starts with having the humility to say that there's a lot of things that you and your team doesn't know, and from that point is where you can find out more by talking to your customers. Second, audience research can't work in siloed product, sales, and marketing team. Using Caitlin's How Might We exercise, you can take your insights into suggestions and improvement for the product, sales, and marketing team. I really like that exercise. I'm going to be using that. So she asked, how might we use this insight in the copy for the marketing team, in the product, in the sales process? This is one of the ways to make sure that your audience research actually makes an impact on your company, and it doesn't just gather dust somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And finally, always communicate the value of your work. I really like how Caitlin put her work is that she's really trying to use audience research to find the best customers and the triggers that causes them to buy so you can sell more stuff. She doesn't talk about audience research first, she talks about the value that audience research brings. Caitlin said that the way to get buy-in from leadership team of any company to do audience research is by communicating that value of audience research first. Now, if you want to show my show notes and my key takeaways that I just mentioned in written format, because sometimes I just like to read what I just said, I also have tweetable quotes that Caitlin have said. You can go to growthmarketing.today/044, or you can go to the link in the description of this episode and whatever app you're using for your podcast. And like I said, if you're new here, please subscribe to wherever you get your podcast. As always, I'd appreciate it very much if you leave a review wherever you get your podcast. And if that's Apple Podcasts, I'd really appreciate a 5-star review so we can reach more marketers with this podcast. Other than that, this is Ramley John. And as always, keep on growing.